The work to separate you and me by color is on purpose. It was strategic and it had a starting point. Because the true division is really not about color, it is about money and power. You might have these moments in life, I know I definitely have, where I'm like, I look at this date and I'm like, after this date, things totally changed. It was everything before that date, everything after that date. And we can look at Bacon's Rebellion that way. I am Danielle Romero. Thank you so much for being with me here on my channel, where we talk about American history and family stories. I think this might be one of the most important videos I have ever sat down to do, which is kind of scary, and it has kept me from making this video. But perfect is the enemy of good. At least I think that's how it goes. It's okay if something is not 100% before it goes out, because nothing is really going to ever be 100%. I'm sure I'll make some mistakes in this video, leave some stuff out. Feel free to jump in, correct me, have a conversation. I always welcome that. And if you would like an ad-free experience off of YouTube, please join me over at my Patreon. It's a great community. I post things ahead of time. There's no ads on any videos. I post some behind the scenes stuff. If you'd like to connect, that's a great way to do it. We're going to talk today about why you use the term black people and white people. Now, this in particular is the most relevant to Americans, but I think it is relevant to everybody. Now, I'm not here to tell anyone how they should identify. Lord knows that I have been through a long journey of understanding what identity looks like here in the United States when we're talking about ethnic identity, color identity, racial identity, all of that. I'm not here to tell you how to identify. I'm not here to tell you what words to use. But it is very important that when we use the terms black and white, to understand where it came from. Now, before we get into the history of this is not to imply that there are no current issues regarding color or race or ethnicity, and that if we could just talk about this history, it would all go away. But it does highlight that at the nation's outset, before America became America, division was strategically implemented to prevent unity among the population. We must understand that when we use these terms right now to create conflict and division and discord, you are using the terms exactly how they were intended to be used. They were meant to bring division. It was meant to bring discord. Why? Bacon's Rebellion and the laws that etched black and white into our nation's psyche. These were tools of the rich elite to sow discord among us. Why do you think we aren't allowed to talk about this? Why do you think my channel has been flagged from here to high heaven multiple times on YouTube? It's because people have been profiting from this division for a long, long time. This was the formal legal creation of black and white, which were born from the embers of Bacon's Rebellion. 1676, a dispute over land and authority sparked a conflict in the Virginia colony, leading to an insurrection that we now call Bacon's Rebellion. But beneath the surface of this power struggle lay the seeds of a far-reaching transformation about how society would come to see and segregate herself. So imagine standing on the shores of Virginia, your eyes looking along the open East Coast. It's not just any land. This is some of the best land. It's the cream of the crop. And most of it has already been snapped up by some of the big aristocrats of the day. And these lands had seen a lot of growth, a lot of prosperity. There's a lot of money there, thanks in part to the Peace of Pocahontas, partly through the aftermath of the Second Powhatan War. The aristocrats had a really cushy, nice territory for themselves carved out. And sometimes they would sell bits of their territory to newcomers who were coming in, who were also considered elite. So into this scene steps a newcomer, William Berkeley. He is a man fresh from the court of Charles I in England. He was knighted for his work and his loyalty. He was also a man with a lot of connections. He was appointed as the governor of Virginia in the Virginia colonies in 1641, where he very quickly set up shop with his own plantation near Jamestown, fitting right in with the elite. But Berkeley wasn't just about planting crops. He led a decisive attack against the Powhatan Nation, bringing an end to the Third Powhatan War. Now, the peace treaty basically It granted him and his buddies a lucrative monopoly on the deerskin and fur trade. Nathaniel Bacon steps in. He wants to keep pushing out into the indigenous land. There's more land. You have these aristocrats who basically have all the good land. And Nathaniel Bacon is well off, but he's not as well off as these guys. And he's thinking, if I could just push out west a little bit, we could have a plantation for ourselves. We could have land. He kind of riles up the lower class of people. And this lower class were considered lower class, not based on skin color, because this was a mix of people who would later be considered white and black, but it was, again, based on class in the truest sense of the word. And he wants to push out into these territories. Governor Berkeley says, no. Like, we're not going to do that. I want to maintain the trade with the Native Americans. And we might look at Governor Berkeley and say, he's a good guy. He is protecting indigenous people. He doesn't want to push into the land. But that's not really the case. This is a self-serving move. It's a self-righteous move because he could say, well, I don't want to push into that territory. We're not going to give you military protection and power to do that because I want to keep these treaties that I've got going. He's got all these deals happening for him and his friends on the side. Well, Nathaniel Bacon wants a piece of the pie. And this is how it always goes, because the true division is really not about color. It is about money and power. Nathaniel Bacon was described as charismatic and courageous, and he was supposed to represent the disenfranchised. And he rallied support for his cause against the colonial government and its refusal to support westward expansion. And so in defiance, Bacon and a group of colonists launched attacks against the Native American communities in 1676, leading Berkeley to label him a traitor. So this conflict escalates until Bacon takes control of Jamestown. And so Nathaniel Bacon ends up burning Jamestown with his militia, with his group. He ends up getting like a fever or dysentery or something, and he dies just a couple weeks later, and the revolt is squashed. But now the Virginia elite are realizing something. They're realizing that this class of people who they had written off as just worthless were actually able to band together and be heard and be people of action. And this terrified the elite. They were so scared of this happening again that they realized they had to create a way to divide these people even further. So now you have the class distinction, and now we're going to divide by color. Here in the wake of this conflict, colonial leaders began to draw lines that had not existed before. Ability to vote and partake in any kind of governance, to have a say in what's going on, was tied to land ownership. So this further marginalized who was able to participate. If you were poor or you didn't have land for whatever reason, you didn't get a say in what was going on. Bacon's Rebellion stands out for its unprecedented coalition of black and white indentured servants and slaves, along with African slaves, who were all united in opposition to colonial authority. Often we want to say, well, who is the good guy in this and who is the bad guy? And really, that's not always how life works. In response to the perceived threat of a unified front of indentured servants and slaves, colonial authorities began to implement laws that formalized racial distinctions. So here, this is where history gets really tough and it gets really nuanced. And it's hard to grapple with, because on one hand, I would look at this and say, well, Bacon was totally wrong. Like, we shouldn't, you know, the way he wants to treat the indigenous people here, we totally disagree with. So on one hand, we can agree with that. But on the other hand, he was able to round up this militia, not based on color, but by class. And you have all of these people who are feeling disenfranchised and not heard. It's really hard to break this into, well, who are the good guys and who are the bad guys? After they crushed this revolt, it marked the beginning of legally enforced racial segregation and slavery. So following Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, everything shifted. Everything changed. You know, sometimes you might have these moments in life, I know I definitely have, where I'm like, I look at this date and I'm like, after this date, things totally changed. It was everything before that date, everything after that date. And we can look at Bacon's Rebellion that way. The aftermath of the uprising saw a significant transformation on how the colony's laws addressed race and servitude. So we need to get back to that servitude part, underscoring a deliberate move towards the codification of color and racial distinctions in a legal framework. This would eventually evolve into the institution of slavery in America. In the years immediately following the rebellion, Virginia's legislature began to enact a series of regulations known as the Black Codes. These laws curtailed the freedoms of Africans and their descendants, starkly delineating rights and privileges based on racial lines. And by 1680, only 4 years after Bacon's Rebellion, a pivotal law was passed prohibiting what was now called blacks, both free and enslaved, from bearing arms. So this is not just an issue of we are even further separating those who are indentured servants or those who are considered a slave. We are saying if you are considered black, you cannot have a gun. You cannot protect yourself. And this has nothing to do with class anymore. Now it has to do with color, because they weren't able to separate this based on class. It wasn't working. This legislation also forbade the assembly of large groups of blacks, as they put it, a clear attempt to thwart any potential for collective action or rebellion. Furthermore, it mandated severe punishment for slaves who dared to assault Christians or attempt escape. And so now the hierarchy is changing. It's going from a class system. Are you a landowner or are you not? To a color system. Now, as these laws proliferated, Virginia declared in 1682 that all imported black servants would be enslaved for life. This is a 180 on what was happening before. So before, you were considered, for the most part, an indentured servant, and there was at least in theory the possibility of freedom. And we won't get into all of that in this video, but I would like to touch on that. But this period also saw New York, who was following Virginia's lead, making it illegal for enslaved people to sell goods in 1684, so further restricting the economy of those people who are called black. The introduction of these black codes and the subsequent slave laws, and I'm going to say slave laws because that's what they were called at the time, represented a seismic shift towards a society that was now organized starkly along color and racial lines. These laws were reflective of the colonial authorities' fears of a united front among people who were disenfranchised. And it laid the foundation for that system of chattel slavery, we're coming back to that now. So before, depending on the circumstances you were born into or whether or not you were considered an indentured servant, there was this possibility of freedom. Not anymore. Now, you were deemed, your status was set for life based on your mother's condition. So if your mother was enslaved, you'll be enslaved. This legal framework sanctioned the enslaver's rights to control, abuse, kill those that they enslaved. And there were ripple effects for this that we know. The rebellion had dire consequences for the Native Americans who were already here. They were caught between the colonial settlers and the colonial government. And the destruction of villages by Bacon's forces exemplifies the violence that was inflicted on these populations. So it's very difficult to look at Bacon's Rebellion and come out feeling good on the other side, to say either the good guy won or the bad guy lost or whatever, because in many ways, everyone stinks in this situation. Everyone's terrible in this situation. I'm not surprised that it's not often covered in history courses, because it's super complex and there's even more nuance to this. I mean, this is just like the 101 version on it. This transcends, I think, just a mere power struggle, which on some level it looks like it's just a power struggle between two rich British guys. You know, in the rebellion's wake, though, the landscape of Virginia was forever altered. There was a fear that gripped the elite. They were afraid that at any point now, this lower class of people who couldn't vote and didn't count could band together and make their will known. And so the aftermath of this story is one of division and distinction. And the unity that existed between the indentured servants of across color lines and racial lines was shattered by a deliberate legal and social reform. This is difficult. This is a very difficult topic, and I think it needs more than one video. But I think the biggest takeaway is that the work to separate you and me by color is on purpose. It was strategic and it had a starting point. Now, that's not to say that there's not colorism or racism or whatever has never happened until we get the Bacon's Rebellion. Of course not. But when we're talking about white and black being codified, these are legal standings. Are you legally black and you can't bear arms and you can't gather and you can't do all these different things, or are you legally white? That's why it's so important when we look 100 years later, when Thomas Jefferson writes the words, "All men are created equal." Who is he referring to? Now, I'm someone that believes that these documents are living, breathing documents and that they have the ability to expand as our country is growing, as we are expanding as people. But when the founding fathers in 1790 were figuring out how do we naturalize new citizens into this new nation, they said a free white man of good character. There was no consideration for anything else. They probably didn't even need to say white. It was probably just understood to be white based on what had happened 100 years prior. And no, we're not still operating underneath these codes or these laws. There is an indelible mark left on us. And we still fall into this of being manipulated along these color lines. Read the news, watch the TV, listen to how people talk. It's always white versus black, black versus white. And so, again, I would never tell someone, this is how you should identify. These are the words you should use. No. But if you're going to use these words and it's creating discord, it's creating separation, it's creating division, know that that was the intent all along.